If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. Why did Christianity become embedded across Western Europe in the centuries after the end of the Roman Empire? How far did the old gods of Rome still survive? And how did the concept of being Christian change over the course of the Middle Ages? In today's podcast, Professor Mark Pegg of Washington University considers these questions in conversation with Dave Musgrove.
Mark, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast today. You've written a cracking book called Beatrice's Last Smile, A New History of the Middle Ages. And it's a big book with a lot in it. But what I want to try and explore with you is quite a specific question of why Western Europe became Christian. So I'm going to sort of frame the conversation around that. And I'm sure we'll go wider as we go. So you start off your book with a martyrdom story at the start of the third century. And this woman, Vibia Perpetua, she's arrested for being Christian, and she ends up meeting an unpleasant, gory death in Carthage in an amphitheatre with wild animals. That's one of the main things that a lot of people would feel they know about Christians in the Roman Empire, and they were persecuted and met these horrible deaths. I wonder, is that true? Is that an accurate sort of reflection of the general Christian experience, or is this like the worst thing that happened and there was a lot of other Christians who managed to live much less challenging lives than poor old Vibia Perpetua?
Most Christians were not like her. Most Christians, and I think it's only 10% of the Roman Empire at the time, it's been estimated, were Christians. So say the Roman Empire has, what, 50 to 60 million people living within it. So it's a very small percentage. And she herself is therefore quite a radical Christian. Most Christians were kind of middling, mediocre persons who got on with life, were left alone, who worshipped the emperor. She's radical. And the reason I start with her, though, is because, one, she writes her own, an amazing diary while she's in prison. She's just given birth. She writes a diary. And then we, as you rightly say, we then discover her death. But one could certainly argue she is in many ways a classical Roman woman. She's a noble woman. But she's also very much a precursor, a foretaste of the kind of medieval world that we think of with saints, or an understanding of a kind of around holiness, of kind of medieval holiness. There's always this sense of potential violence, a sense of divinity captured with violence that's also meant to be beautiful and sacrificial. And I think that's where she's very much shows us a late Roman, the end of the classical Roman world that leads us into what can be called the early Middle Ages or late antiquity. She's unusual. She and her friends are radical Christians. Most Christians are not like that. It's not until at least, what, a hundred or a century later that we have under Diocletian, we have the so-called Great Persecutions, the Emperor Diocletian. And that's where Christians throughout the empire are systematically, or at least systematically, accused and therefore somewhat persecuted. It's our image from old movies and everything else, but it's not correct. until a century later.
How would you describe the nature of Christianity in the later Roman Empire, in the 3rd, 4th century? Can you make any generalizations about how people who thought of themselves as Christians actually thought of their faith and their relationship with God?
Our word religion comes from the Roman word religiones, singular religio, which means a good translation of it is just like discipline, correct behavior, meaning that your worshipping of the old gods is the whole universe is split with thousands of threads, if you like, of the noumena, right? The noumen, like holy threads. And the correct rituals you have before the gods, or even door handles in your house or your family rituals, so misfortune doesn't happen to you. So you don't trip over these threads, if you like. But morality, if you like, or ideas of sort of good and evil, for all intents and purposes, that's what philosophers, particularly elite people, think. This is what philosophy gives you. That's not what religion gives you. Whereas you could argue that Christianity, and in many ways they're absolutely copying this from Judaism, it combines these two ideas. It combines correct religious practice with a kind of morality. And secondly, I would also argue, we certainly, at least we can sort of start seeing it in some Christian writers in the 3rd and 4th, is that they think of themselves, even if they think of themselves as a minority, they think of themselves as perhaps scattered and lost in this world, this Roman Empire, or even outside the Roman Empire. They do start thinking of themselves as all part of a broader community that's universal. So there's a sense that even if they themselves are like isolated, they may be part of a broader world. Whereas part of the, for many, I would say, Roman to believe in the old gods, part of the virtue is that it's an intensely localized sensibility that every city has its own gods, its own rituals. And people even visiting these cities understand this sort of, this cacophony of holy noise, if you like, which I think Marcus Aurelius refers to it as once, is what holds the empire together, this sort of ability that sort of this, it's very disparate, and you understand that holiness is fractured, but it all holds together, whereas Christians don't. Christians try and understand it as being universal, even if they themselves think of themselves as the minority. But as I said, having said that, if one were a Christian in the 3rd century or 4th, you still assume the old gods exist. They don't disappear for you. For, say, famously, Anthony of Egypt, who I talk about, so-called the first monk, if you like, you know, for him, the old gods just become demons, but they don't disappear. The long shadows of the old gods still follow Christians everywhere they go. So they don't think of their universe as totally Christian. It's still full of these old gods. And so that's how, that's how Christians would think of themselves. But powerfully, even if they think of themselves as like united and just, should we say, universal church, which we eventually would say ecumenical. I mean, you know, if we think of the word ecumenical, which comes out of like the idea, even after Alexander the Great, you know, Greek-speaking world, that was the universe. For the Romans, it was the Roman Empire. That's everybody. And then for Christians, it becomes the whole world is, there always are Christians everywhere, and hence ecumenical. So, but what surprises them then is then when someone like the Emperor Constantine says, like the Council of Nicaea, or says Christians are no longer persecuted, and then raises up their bishops, these local leaders, into sort of imperial officials. And then that sort of transforms their understanding of themselves, certainly throughout the 4th century. But, you know, also we can then say that the soldiers, you know, say the Roman legions, because the emperor himself now follows the highest god, which, you know, he now understands as a Christian god, they themselves become Christians. And so much of the army and the officialdom themselves become Christians. And so I think there's a kind of escalation of what it means to be Christian, because it's just that's what it is to be a follower of the emperor. And to be particularly, the paradox here is that it coincides with the empire becoming much more authoritarian. That's what Diocletian set in place, even though I don't think he would have thought that Christianity would be the outcome. But there's no question that his authoritarian empire of the late 3rd to the 4th century, which Emperor Constantine takes over, also aids in the Christianization of the empire, is that this is a much more authoritarian empire than, say, under Augustus or Marcus Aurelius. So I do think that's also how Christianity works.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/History Extra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/History Extra.
If I want to understand why the West, why Western Europe and then later the West became Christian, do I just need to look at that figure you've mentioned several times, Constantine, and the fact that he said that Christianity was okay, he saw the light, and then everybody was able to follow him?
It's a much debated question. Would the empire have Christianized without, say, Constantine, or would Christianity have just been one of many religions? I think it's unquestionably important. I mean, as I argue, I do think when he has his, you know, the famous revelation where he looks up and sees the sun, he sees the famous image, and then he puts the shields, and anyhow, we're talking about the civil wars. I actually don't think he necessarily realizes it's the Christian God at first. I would argue that. I think he knows it's the highest God, so it's very much a monotheistic idea. But one could absolutely argue, and his father famously was a believer in the victorious sun. So he also had a kind of notion of monotheism. I should say, this is one of these interesting questions, is that you could even see a kind of monotheism powerfully already taking place amongst believers in the old gods already in the third century too. What I mean is, and we see it even famously said in the fourth century by a guy called Symmachus, a senator in Rome, is that all these various gods are just manifestations of the one God. And this is a believer in the old gods, like many gods. So kind of a belief in one God, monotheism, was already coming into play in the third century anyhow. And so I think Constantine, when he talks about his one God, I would argue he only comes to realize pretty soon, it's the Christian God. But does that make him want to be a Christian? No. Does that mean he stops the persecution of Christians? Yes. I think it takes a long life for him to come to fundamentally grasp what it means for him to be a Christian, and that the Christian God is the God of empire. And everybody understanding the God that he now worships. But, you know, but at the same time, Constantine did not stop the belief in the old gods. Even when he founds Constantinople, there's still the old gods, you know, come to live there too. He stops all sacrifices. But honestly, one could argue most sacrifices are really stopped anyhow. Like people were, I mean, you know, you probably know the famous story of Julian the Apostate, who tries to turn the empire back to being pagan again or Hellenistic. In the middle of the fourth century, I think it would have failed. I think by that stage it was inevitable that the empire was going is Christianity, because most of the army was, most of the elites had become that way. Can we say most ordinary Romans? I think that's a hard one to judge, though the few inscriptions we have suggest that they totally were willing to see the Christian God as part of the world they were talking about. But yes, I think Constantine, at least tolerating Christianity and then following his one highest God, absolutely changes or helps transform what it means, the Christianization of the West, absolutely. And that Christianity comes to become the dominant, if you like, religion. But as I've said a number of times here, it's not what it means to be a Christian, say, in the 4th century, is very different to what it means in the 11th century and the 12th century. One of the great seductive achievements of religion as I say earlier, is a denial of history, right? The idea, you know, I'm not a religious person, but I can understand this, is that if you're someone now who thinks they're, say, Christian or Muslim, whatever, you are exactly the same kind of person when you pray as someone who prayed 1,000 years ago, that there's a continuity, that not just a continuity, it's the same kind of idea. That's not history. I mean, part of what I was trying to get across in the book is that this shifts and changes so often, even down to the really, it sounds like a really banal thing to say, but the idea that Christ is even important fades in much of the early medieval world. But yes, I do, I guess I'm trying not to sound like too mechanistic, but yes, I do think Constantine's conversion is inescapably important.
Is it also a key factor that the instruments of empire become associated with Christianity? Is that another key reason why Christianity becomes embedded in what becomes Europe?
Yes, absolutely. The machinery of empire comes to use Christianity. That's a better way of even thinking about it, that the machinery of empire starts using the structures or apparatus of these disparate Christian churches, which had their bishops, which themselves by the 3rd century had become not just religious leaders, holy leaders, but also, if you like, administrative leaders themselves within the small Christian communities, that these administrative leaders, what we call bishops of local churches, so if you think of the local church as a small C church, who would interrelate with imperial officials, but also who were feeding the poor, Christian poor, who were, you know, looking after their various communities. By the time we get to the 4th century, where they're being absorbed into the machinery of empire, these bishops are now doing things on behalf of the emperor. And they're more than happy to be absorbed into this universe. What's interesting, and usually the argument is made, is that in the eastern half of the empire, bishops, for the most part, are kind of run-of-the-mill administrators, always sort of more under the authority of the emperor or under the authority of imperial officials. In the West, though, certainly from the 4th century onwards, bishops become much grander figures. They see themselves as having more power and being on an equal with the emperor. I mean, this is the paradox here. If the emperor shares a bit of his power now with these bishops, they run with it. And certainly in the West, that becomes an obsession that the bishops themselves are these almost independent figures sometimes. So yes, absolutely, you're absolutely right. It's that the empire absorbs rather sophisticated but very localized administrative structures of the Christian churches, absorbs them into the machinery of empire, transforms them into sort of bureaucrats, imperial bureaucrats as well, but also then transforms, if you like, lots of these small C churches into the big C church, right? That they understand themselves really powerfully now as part of a vast church governed by bishops, right? Bishops are being the most important people.
And so does that then mean, and you touched on this earlier, did that then mean that by that point it was essentially inevitable that Christianization would take root and become Christianity become the dominant religion across Europe?
I think it's inevitable that the empire and then the West keeps Christianizing. Part of it is because I think it's what makes a person a Christian, how you define as having authority in Christianity, how you define as being, keeps shifting and changing. So part of its inevitability, if you like, is a powerful flexibility that it keeps shifting and changing and absorbing and becoming different styles of Christianity in the West. I would start argue in the West in particular. And so I think it is inevitable. As I said, partially because, you know, if the authority of the person who feeds you in the 4th or 5th century when the empire collapses in the West, and I do think the Roman Empire falls, I do think the empire falls in the West, I think that's a perfectly good reason to become Christian. Someone who protects you, someone who ransoms you. When we talk about Christians being kidnapped and ransomed as the empire collapses in the West, those to me seem powerful reasons to become Christian. That these are people protecting you, feeding you, looking after you. Therefore, that's a sincere reason to believe in the one God, the Christian God.
You've given lots of reasons as to why Christianity as a monotheistic religion came to dominate. I wonder if they all also point to the explanation as to why the old gods didn't linger? Why did those old gods die away?
I think the old gods die away because you have lots, for instance, you have emperors at the end of the 4th and 5th century who start banning the worship of the old gods, you know, so you can't have certain rituals. I think they die away because the old gods, and this is, and we often have Christian writers saying this, quite sophisticated argument about, the old gods require public performances, right, require money. Those great old temples we think of when we think of pagan temples and that, that's where the gods lived. All rituals for paganism take place outside. And so if no one's funding these temples or if this public performance isn't happening, then I do think that also leads to the disappearance of the old gods in that sense. I mean, belief in the old gods is a very public performance thing, whereas Christianity, at least as elite Christians would write, can still take place privately. You don't need to see other Christians praying to know other Christians exist. There's a sensibility that it seems as though one could argue that to believe in the old gods is very much a public performance and you have to see other people doing it. Now, as I told you, lots of elite believers in the old gods start, you know, they start imagining their universe as being monotheistic too, right? There's a one god which manifests in all these other gods, right? That, you know, so forth and so on. Why I find this a fascinating question, because it is, when do the old gods disappear? Because, you know, there's a slight burst of belief after 411, you know, when the sack of Rome by Alaric, and then some elite Romans particularly, but even other Romans start saying, oh, following Christianity was a mistake. They sort of don't think they can overturn Christianity, but there's an assumption that we have to bring back belief in the old gods. But it's a deeply learned belief in the sense of, you read Virgil, you know, it's sort of, it's very the seminar room. It's seminar room paganism, or it's seminar room, as they would say, Hellenism. And that's, you know, famously Augustine of Hippo writes his City of God attacking it. But by that stage, even then, it's sort of calcified into this kind of studious seminar room kind of intellectualization of what belief in the old gods. And I only, why I bring this up like this is because I'm very skeptical when people want to say continuity of old beliefs, you know, up until, say, the 13th, 14th century. That's what they say the inquisitors discover when they discover people worshipping the old gods. I think that's nonsense. I just don't believe there's a continuity. I think in that sense, Christianity has become inescapable, that it's even shaped belief in the old gods, that even if some people are doing certain rituals that they're accused of being pagan, I think they see it within a... I don't think they are. I think they're seen within a Christian context. But certainly, I think the old gods have disappeared by the 5th century. I think a belief in the old gods, I think they have faded away. And I generally think people, they start, you know, they get absorbed into the world of demons for Christians. But part of it is, it's because they really require the structures of empire. And yes, you may come across law codes by emperors or other people saying all pagans have to convert within 3 months. I think Justinian says that in the 6th century. I don't think there are any pagans left. They may have a copy of Plato on their bookshelf or Plotinus, but I don't think that makes them pagan, even though that's often the accusation. So I really do think they fade away. And this is getting back to your question about inevitability. So what fills that space? And I think Christianity has come very much for all levels of society to fill the space that the old gods once held. Part of it is patronage, imperial structures, I think a faith in what they can give you. I think even amongst intellectuals who sort of have an intellectualized version of paganism or Platonism, that has faded away too. I just don't believe there's a continuity of paganism hidden in the soil of the West that sort of bubbles up every so often that people like inquisitors discover or so forth and so on. I think they're gone by the 5th century.
So sort of moving the story on a bit into the later period, I guess that in terms of continuity, there must have been some continuity of structures of empire, administrative structures, to allow Christianity to blossom and remain, which leads me on to my next question, is to why didn't other monotheistic religions have more success of sort of inserting themselves into the remains of the Roman Empire? Was that purely political by that point because the structures were so embedded and Christianity had fused with them?
Well, no. What's interesting about that is the empire in the West, for want of a better word, crumples from within, right? So though the empire in the East, capital Constantinople, powerfully keeps pumping along, right? It really does things do crumple in the West. And that's what I mean. I don't think there's like a barbarian invasion to destroy the Roman Empire. I think all the so-called barbarians desperately want to be Romany, want to be Romans. I think the empire itself is already collapsing from within. I certainly think what's fascinating about this is that as the empire in the West sort of collapses from within, what you end up having is lots of little res publicas, like lots of little Romes everywhere, if you like, people hanging on to what they think it is to be Roman. And part of what it means to hang on to be Roman is to hang on to be Christian. I mean, you know, I think, as I say in the book, there's the famous Patricius who becomes St. Patrick. You know, he's living in Britain in the 4th century. Just to use that as an example, I think Britain is one of the most remarkable examples of a whole culture collapsing in a short space of time, Roman Britain, in the world. I mean, what is it, something like by 420 or something, when there are no cities, they're all disappeared. like, no one knows how to make nails anymore. But Patricius, when he writes his famous confession, part of what it is for him to be Roman, and when he's writing this at the end of the 5th century, we're already talking about all the boat people coming from, you know, what we now call Scandinavian countries who are settling in southeast Britain. He barely mentions them, but he hangs on to what it is to be Roman is part of being Christian. So I do think there's a lot of that also when you say it's inevitable. For a lot of people in the West, what it means to be Roman without an empire is to be Christian. And Patricius creates, if you like, his own bishopric, but it's incredibly, for want of a better word, between Ireland and Northern Britain, roughly, this sort of his own kingdom of God, he calls it, which is doesn't really have these structures of empire, but what it clings to is what it believes it is to be a Roman, hanging on to these ideas of what it is to be a Roman. And, you know, he worries about his Latin is not good because he was captured as a slave when he was young and so forth and so on. So I do think part of your question of inevitability is also amongst certain elites, and Patricius seems to have come from an elite, his father was a deacon, elite family in Northern Britain. But without an empire, what do you cling to? What do you hang on to? And part of it is Christianity. But then, you know, famously, these barbarian groups start converting to Christianity or become Christians, like, you know, famously Clovis and in Gaul. So, yeah, so part of it is an interesting question here. As the structures of empire fracture and crumble in the West, what is left gets tied in with what they think it means to be Roman. And famously, you know, Romanitas, you know, Romanness and Christianitas come to mean the same thing, blur together. So I do think that's sort of one of the most fascinating things about the medieval, early medieval West, is this fracturing into, as Peter Brown would call them, micro-Christendoms, and yet Christianity still is capturing, like, is still holding it together, but often holding it together by a sense of what it means to be Roman. So whereas in the East, East Roman Empire pumps along. You know, the emperors in Constantinople are powerful, and until we talk about, you know, the great Arab invasions of the 7th century. It is interesting still question, though, why does this monotheism continue? And I think because it's tied in with an assumption of what it means to be Roman. Even when there's no empire, people are still clinging to this idea in the West. In the East, it's more obvious and powerful. And even though you didn't mention it, I mean, you know, as I say in the book, there's no question that, say, someone like Muhammad, when he has his revelations are the highest God too. It's like it's the same God as Constantine. I mean, you know, his revelations in the early 7th century, unquestionably, in many ways, as he says, you know, the Quran is meant to be an end of days book. So it's meant to be this last message from God. But it's meant to end the whole debate you and I have sort of been having. We should probably move forward. But this whole debate about what does it mean to think of one God that was going on from the 3rd century. And Muhammad says, no, we stop now. We've got it. And so his highest God is exactly the same God as Constantine's. But then the question is, there's a monotheistic religion. I mean, he powerfully thinks of himself as a Puritan, monotheistic Puritan. But that kind of notion, even though we talk about the conquest of the Iberian Peninsula, you know, in 711, I don't think Islam was ever going to, if that's what you mean, another monotheistic religion, was ever going to absorb what we call the West. I think that, you know, I think that's one of the great myths of sort of the Battle of Poitiers and all that, that Islam was going to sweep through the West. No, it wasn't. I mean, if nothing else, most Western writers just initially thought of Islam as a form of heresy, Christian heresy.
But there's one thing I really do want to talk about before we finish, though, which is this idea of how Christianity changes, or the concept, the idea of Christianity changes from the start of your period to the end. You've touched a bit as we've talked about how the figure of Christ himself may have been not as important as we might imagine. But I wonder if you could just try to encapsulate some of the key changes from how somebody, a 3rd century Christian and a 15th century Christian, might have envisaged their faith. What were the key differences?
What is interesting is that I do think a distinct Western culture starts developing. One of those distinctive qualities about it, and I do think, is a different understanding of the afterlife. For instance, let's just say the end of the 6th century. Let's say the end of the 7th century is a better way of putting it. We start having in the West, and by the way, I'm defining the West very generally and broadly. As I prefer in the book, I particularly want to get into after, say, the 5th and 6th century, I used Christendoms or Latin Christendom, because I think that's a much more powerful understanding of how people living in this world thought of themselves, at least. Getting back to your notion of Christianity, that had a more powerful idea of giving people a sense of where they lived or how the world they were in, that they were part of a Christendom, or even little Christendoms, than something they would never have thought of themselves as being in Europe. Anyhow, at the end of the 7th century, certainly you could argue, in the West, unlike, say, any other culture in the Mediterranean, in the Eastern world, Mediterranean world, is that we start having people imagining that humans actually leave their souls and fly to heaven at night. That one assumes by looking in the night sky that you know that souls are flying above you and that they're flying to heaven and hell and so forth and so on. And we have nothing like that anywhere, people writing like that in any other culture of this, around this world. And that's a distinctly Western phenomenon that we start seeing being written about. That, to me, is a huge shift, this idea of the afterlife in the 7th century. Distinctly separates Christendom, Latin Christendom, let's call it that, away from, say, East Rome or what people would call the Byzantine Empire, East Roman Empire, the rising Islamic world, and so forth and so on. One of the things I try and argue is that I think there's what comes into play as a called penitential culture. And what I mean by that is that every sin you do, there's a correct penance for it. And if you do that penance, your slate's wiped clean. And if you do the sin again, slate's white plain. So a perfect life is this kind of jump cut, so that when you end up dying and go to heaven, you're bleached of all humanity, you're bleached of all sexuality, of your gender. Like, the perfect person in heaven is kind of bland. So you have this penitential culture, right? And penitentials are like these little guidebooks that, you know, they're like, they try and imagine every possible sin someone can do, every possible thing they can do. But also, if you go on a pilgrimage, your penances are wiped clean. And so you can do the sin again, right? Just do the penance. But this shift starts taking place in the 11th century and into the 12th century. And then I call that into rise into a confessional culture. And what I mean by that is it's a sense of the self as continuously moving through time, that the small child you were actually has some relationship to you as a young adult, as to you as an old person, so forth and so on. I know that sounds like a very modern sense of the self, but it's not. It's not natural to think of ourselves like that, that what we did as children has some huge bearing on us right now. And because, as I said, the penitential culture is jump cuts. What starts shifting is the idea that there's an unbreakable continuity in our lives, that we move through time in a forward motion, that there's a linear sense of self. A lot of that is based on obsession with the life of Christ. I think that it's hard to say the two come together. We get a burst of autobiography for the first time in the 12th century that we hadn't really seen for 500 or 600 years. And obviously the idea of confession, right, that you talk about yourself and that you see connections in your life. And what I mean by that, and why I think this is a powerful model that shows a huge shift, is that, not surprisingly, we start getting ideas of purgatory and heaven and hell, and that the person you are in death is a continuity of you in life. That you are the same person in death. Remember I told you, I said in the penitential culture, the kind of perfect person in heaven when you die is kind of bland. You want to be bleached of all your identity in some sense. Whereas now it carries over. Not surprisingly, if you think of it like that, the first time we really get ghosts in the West is around 1200. These are people who have died, they are real people. And so part of what I'm trying to get across here is this shift in identity, how you understand what makes a human. It's a really, for me, a profound shift. Famously, the Fourth Lateran Council says everybody has to confess once a year. But really, it's the rise of things like the Inquisition that sort of start telling people how to think about themselves. And so, and I even mean peasants. What I'm talking about here is that the ability to talk about yourself and that to see connections in your life, that things you thought were innocent now have huge implications because you have to think how the connection goes. And it's just incredibly new in the 12th and into the 13th century. And that's just not how an early medieval person thought of themselves. And in many ways, you may do still penances for a sin, but you can be asked about it again. It never leaves your identity. That's a better way of putting it. The penitential culture means you can wipe the slate clean. You never can in the high Middle Ages, from the 12th, 13th centuries onwards. Whatever sin you do is always part of your identity, even if you confess it. And so end up talking about yourself also becomes in and of itself all that you need to do. And therefore, if that leads to you, then in death, you are exactly the same kind of person you were in life. Therefore, and you know, famously, purgatory is between heaven and hell, and that has our sense of time too. So, you know, if you like, our world spills over into the afterlife. But I do think that's a huge shift from this penitential culture of the early medieval world. And when I say, and ironically, the penitential culture, again, don't get me wrong, Christ is important, but they rarely talk about Christ in the same way. You know, there's that famous English poem, The Dream of the Rood, which is all about the cross being crucified, not about Christ. The cross even gets annoyed at one point, saying he goes up to heaven to be with his Father, and here I am with the wounds and his blood on me. So it's not obvious that Christ is even crucial to understanding what it is to be a Christian, but that obsession with Christ is also very much a defining idea from the 12th and 13th century onwards. But part of that defining idea is what leads and shapes into ideas of autobiography, identity, a sense of self. And as I say, a sense of self that I'm assuming most of you, the listeners, think of what makes a Western person now, that you and I have some connection to ourselves as little children, and that you can predict that I will be the same person a month from now or a year from now. Believe it or not, that's not natural. And that's a creation of the 12th and 13th centuries and makes the West very distinctly different. So I should also say, part of what also the phenomenon it ties in to is, if you think of the early medieval West, Christendoms, if you like, as having borders, there's still like in a sense of that Christendom itself doesn't encompass the world. Christians may be in the world, but all these little Christendoms. And even when Urban II proclaims the First Crusade, right, 1095, he certainly has an assumption there's a world outside Christendom, right? That the Crusaders, there's no word for Crusaders yet, but the Pilgrims, as he calls them, they do still think they're leaving Christendom, Latin Christendom, to go and help the emperor in Constantinople initially. What I mean by that is, but famously, Innocent III, perhaps the greatest pope of the Middle Ages, and this is an idea you could say anyhow around 1200, that all humans who have ever lived in all time and space is Christendom. So all humans who have ever lived have had the revelation of Christ. So Christendom encompasses the world. And that means everybody in the world has had the revelation of Christ. And if they are deliberately not choosing to be Christian, then they start being accused of being heretics. Not just heresy within the West, but also Jews start being identified, called heretics in the 13th century. Muslims are identified as heretics. Even Mongols are called heretics. So this is a really powerful idea, that the idea that Christendom encompasses the whole world and all time and space. Now, I would argue that breaks down, not surprisingly, after the Black Death, right? So it breaks down after the plague years of 1347 to 1349, but 50 stuff and so on. And as Christendom breaks down, this idea of Christendom encompassing the world breaks down, what comes into its place is Europe. What comes into its place is people starting no longer identifying themselves as being Christians, part of Christendom first. They're still Christians, but they're now Christians within kingdoms, within regions, in a way that I don't think we saw there. But I think that's a profound shift in how we understand ourselves, how we understand the past. And if, as I said, if nothing else, it shows that even just something really basic, how you and I think of ourselves, is not obvious or natural. There's no natural way of thinking of yourself.
was Professor Mark Pegg. His book, Beatrice's Last Smile, A New History of the Middle Ages, is published by OUP.
Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Brittany Colley.
A collision between a Chinese jet and an American spy plane.
He came and rammed into our left wing.
With relations increasingly strained, what are the chances of things spinning out of control?
The Western world was asleep.
I'm Gordon Carrera. I'll be exploring the friction in this most important of relationships and asking, has the West taken its eye off the ball?
You cannot ignore China.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Shadow War, China and the West. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.